It makes its funny little hum, and there it is. So tonight, for the first time, we are delighted to welcome the author of There's a God for That. And you see we have many copies here, which are autographable by the author here himself in person today. Joseph Hunton is a author, obviously, a geographer and world traveler. He was married in a Shinto ceremony 3 decades ago and has lived a bicultural life ever since, and has visited some of Japan's remotest places. We are pleased to have him here. He and his wife were traveling on the far side of Japan during the earthquake, tsunami, etc. of 2011. I believe he'll have some thoughts on that subject. And we are so pleased to welcome Joseph Hunton to Many Rivers Books and Tea. Thank you.
And I'm delighted to be here, so thank you for opening up this wonderful space. And the turnout. So what an interesting mix of people that I see, many familiar faces and many new faces, which is the best kind of crowd. Now, I have a challenge, and that is twofold. I'm not new to public speaking. I know how that goes, but I always kind of tank up on caffeine first, and I failed to do that tonight. So at some point, we're going to take a little break, and I have some special tea being prepared in the back at the appropriate time. We will all enjoy that, perhaps, when it's a good time to answer some questions. And the other challenge is, I'm not an expert in this subject matter. It's a matter of exploration. And I think most people that come to Shinto approach it later in their life with an open mind and an open heart and kind of discover that, well, they know what Shinto is all about already because they've sort of lived that life. Now, in order to get to that point with you folks, I have some prepared notes that I'm going to have to follow along and read, because this is the first time I've done this particular talk, and without notes I'm not going to do a very good job. And I have just a couple of copies of these same notes. If anybody learns and needs that kind of help, I will just keep those two copies here, and you can, anybody who want these to follow along, or you just want to listen to them, you do it, okay. And anybody else would, yeah, maybe the two of you could share as we go along with that. So the way I'm going to do this is I just want to speak for a little bit, and then I want to make some reference to some of the books that I have found useful. There's a whole table of books about Shinto. This one in particular, The Essence of Shinto, I will be quoting from tonight. This is a much older book, Shinto the Kami Way. This was written in around 1960, and it still is sort of the authoritative text on the history and some of the basics of the religion. And then, for those that just can't get enough, there's the big book. Now, this is not all about Shinto. This is about Japanese literature, and it covers a span of more than 1,000 years. And fortunately, the part that we need for tonight is just the beginning part of the year. So, those are my references that I'll be reading shortly from. So, the way I want this to work is, I'm just going to go and describe what the talk will entail, and then I'll just kind of dive in. So, as an introduction, what is Shinto? It's a religion, and it's inherently Japanese. I think we all know that. It's syncretic. That is, it's an amalgamation of Taoism and Confucianism and Buddhism, plus its original core beliefs. It's mystical, and therefore it's somewhat ineffable. We can't really put it into words. So this presents a bit of a problem for people that want to read about it or write about it, because it's sort of an experiential type of religion. Nevertheless, there's some good myths and some fun anecdotes that we can draw upon to kind of hear and figure out some clues as to what's going on with the religion. And then there's this intriguing title of 8 million gods, meaning all things animate and inanimate are offspring of kami. Kami meaning the Japanese word for God, or spirit child. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And then I want to get into two core values of Shinto, one being seimi, I need some help pronouncing it, but I think that's the right way, and seichoku. Do you know these? You may not know what I'm talking about. Okay, I will just use my own pronunciation for them when the time comes, and then I will finish up with talk about shrines, which are very important to the religion, and the relevance of Shinto to today's world. So that's sort of the overview of what I'm going to talk about here. So let's begin at that beginning, the religion of Japan. I said, you know, Shinto is essentially a Japanese religion. It's not really practiced anywhere else in the world. As far as I know, the Shinto religion is basically Japanese. Now, there was a brief period in the early 20th century during the Manchurian Wars and the Russian-Chinese-Japanese Wars when it was slightly exported to parts of Korea, parts of China, and perhaps parts of some of the other Pacific Islands. But shortly after World War II, all of those shrines were removed and brought back to Japan. So essentially, a Japanese religion only. The first accounts of Japan that were put into written form are what are called the Kojiki, and that's this one big thick book that I have here. The Kojiki was written in 712 AD, so the early part of the 8th century. That is a mythological set of stories of sort of the creation myth, how the whole world came into being, and it describes some of the gods that were in there and how this childlike spirit generated its own self, and from that the birth of the whole world came about. Now, at the same time that the Kojiki was written, a second set of books called the Nihon Shoki was also written. It was first put down formally in 720, so about the same time, 712, 720. And that's more of a historical account rather than mythological. It's sort of the annals or the chronicles or the history of the reign of the emperors and so forth, and it just goes date by date and what happened when and where. So we get both this mythological and this historical account merged together. They both have some of the same stories. So from that, we can kind of compare and contrast as to the veracity of some of the stories. The creation stories themselves, even though they were put down in written form in that early 8th century period, span all the way back to around 660 BC. So 660 is considered to be, if you kind of go back in time, the birth of Japan. That is the time when the first emperor reigned over Japan. And his name was Jimmu, and he is thought to be, by scholars, to be somewhat legendary. Actually, the first 8 or 9 emperors are considered to be sort of legendary. We're not really sure that they existed other than this written account that we have. And the whole purpose of that Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki, they were written to kind of establish Japan as an entity in itself, to have a self-identity in response to the very powerful Tang Dynasty, which was at that time in China. And that the Tang Dynasty, you know, was sort of gobbling up the whole world. And so the scholars in Japan thought that in order to maintain their own self-identity and to establish themselves credibly, they needed to write this all down and put themselves in reference to themselves rather than in reference to the Chinese. Curiously, though, they didn't have their own written language, and so they used Chinese to write their own history. So a bit of a twist to the story there. I already mentioned that the religion was never brought outside the islands of Japan. The other thing, which is quite remarkable, is Shinto was never really influenced by Christianity. As we look at the history of the world, Christianity and the missionary process beginning in the early 15th century kind of went all over the world. You know, the Portuguese and the Spanish proselytized everywhere. They sent missionaries to South America, to North America, to all parts of Asia. Yet, when Francis Xavier arrived in Japan, he discovered that this message of Christianity, which was salvation from original sin, didn't really work because the Japanese didn't really have this concept of sin or of dirtiness or of something wrong with ourselves. And so people in Japan, even today, just don't seem to get what Christianity is all about because it doesn't really fit with their worldview of the world being a good place and human beings being good people. So that is sort of one of the underlying themes, which to me was kind of refreshing to hear at first. The more I hear it, the more I see that this inherent goodness is actually a key trait of the religion, and a beautiful trait as well. So because of that, Francis Xavier didn't make much progress over there. However, he did establish some Catholic missions in the South Island of Japan, the Kyushu Island, which were there for almost a century. And even today, you will still see remnants of that that strain. However, the advisors to the shogun in 1635 could sort of see the world view and could sort of see what Spain and Portugal were doing and their dominance in the world. And so he promulgated a set of laws, which was to become known as Sakoku, which effectively closed the country. And I think most of us have heard about the closed country of Japan. That went on for nearly 240 years. No one from outside was allowed to come in and trade. No one from Japan was allowed to leave. And so because of that closed nature, the influence from the outside was cut off, and the original form of Shinto was allowed to remain intact without this influence from the outside. Now, that said, there's a big exception to that rule, and that's the question of the Chinese philosophical influence. Shinto is hard even today to figure out where Shinto begins and where some of the Chinese philosophies pick up. I think the story is widely told in today's world of children being, you know, initiated into Shinto as a young at birth, and young people getting married in the Christian faith, and people who die being buried according to Buddhist traditions. And so we have this funny thing happening in Japan where
everybody sort of has multiple religions. And at the same time, when they're asked to fill out, what religion do you follow, they usually say none. Because they're so conflicted as to what is my religion and what does that mean. So the question of the Chinese philosophies, I see it as somewhat problematic because Confucianism and its family-centric, ancestry-based philosophy is very much a Japanese trait. Is that part of Shinto, or did that originally rise from Confucian? I can't figure it out. Same thing with Tao, the other main philosophical strain in China. There's an important creation myth in Shinto about Izanagi no Mikoto and Izanami no Mikoto. These are the two male and female gods who procreated, and from them all the other gods and all the earth and so forth came about. That's sort of the yin and the yang of Tao. But is that originally a Chinese concept, or is that originally a Japanese concept? I'm not sure, because these two accounts that we draw from, one of them makes reference to the yin and yang, and the other kind of doesn't. So we don't really know where the truth lies as far as the influence of Tao. But with Buddhism, I think the influence is very clear. Buddhism and Shinto are intertwined all over the place, and we just can't tease them apart. What we see, we can go to Buddhist temples today, and we'll see Japanese deities there at the side protecting the temple. Isn't that interesting? And vice versa, we have the opposite happening as well. So those two seem to be fused together in an inseparable way, except there are a couple of strains of Shinto who have, over the centuries, decided to kind of pull back and try to separate themselves from Buddhist. One of them being Watari Shinto, and the other being, Yamato Yoshishida Shinto. One of them holds that righteousness and prayer will lead to the union with the kami. Righteousness and prayer. The other holds that a truly purified heart can be the kami's abode. So these are clearly Shinto concepts. Most people, though, have this amalgamated approach to Shinto and the religion and the gods, which encompasses many, many aspects of Buddhism. In fact, some of the Buddhist gods have been given avatars or placeholders as Shinto gods. So we see that there's no real pure strain there. Okay. I was going to go into one more thing here, and then I was going to ask you to do the tea. Is that okay? Okay. And that was this concept of being mystical. And for me, I think this is a really wonderful part about the religion, because I kind of like not having a set of rules to abide. It's sort of an experiential religion. Shinto doesn't have a creed. It doesn't have 10 commandments. It doesn't have the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. It doesn't have all these steps. It's just a way to be in touch with Kami, or with the Great Spirit. It has no founder. It doesn't have a Moses or an Abraham or a Jesus or a Muhammad or a Siddhartha. It doesn't have any key figure in the past that you can say, that's who we're going to hold up, that's who we're going to follow.
It also doesn't have any idols. So worship doesn't worship idols. It doesn't have adoration or veneration. It has instead a communion with the kami. So we ask for kami's blessings, and we open our hearts to receive the blessings of that great spirit. Because of this, I say that it's mystical rather than a creed-based religion. And this becomes the real crux of the problem in terms of learning what Shinto is all about. And I think because of that, it's best to approach it experientially. Now, since I said this was a Japanese religion, the only way you can really experience that is to go to Japan. But if you have been to Japan, you have been to any of the shrines, I think you can appreciate some aspects of it just by breathing in the air, by listening to the sounds around the shrines, and by going through the normal steps that the Japanese do of cleansing yourself, being pure of mind, being open and receptive. And when you do that, when I do that, I can feel that presence of the kami within me. It's not magical. It's mystical. It's something that you can't really put into words. So it's really wonderful. Okay. Yeah. I think at that point I wanted to could. Would this be a good time to take a short break and get the tea ready, you two? Yes? Yeah, okay. So we're going to have some tea prepared, and I'm going on, and you're probably got a few questions rattling around in your head, and I hope that we could make this a little interactive, so we'll start with Stuart.
So I'm interested in whether there's, in the Shinto tradition, any analogy to like a meditation practice or any sort of sets of practices. Like, for instance, Taoism has a certain repertoire of practices. Buddhism has various forms of meditation. Is there anything practice oriented in Shinto?
There are rituals, and there are prescribed practices for opening yourself to receive kami. And these are mostly around water purification, which is called misogi. So misogi is the ritual ablutions of cleansing your hands, washing your mouth, preparing yourself physically to be a receptor of the kami. It's not quite the same in terms of a quiet time or a meditative practice. It's more a set of ritual actions that you can do to prepare your body and your mind to be receptive to receiving the kami into yourself. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it calls up the image of both at Buddhist temples and at Shinto shrines that I've seen in Japan, that there's a water in the cups, and from what I understand, a prescribed washing,
yes,
that one does to purify oneself before,
right,
going into the sacred space.
Right. And if you have the chance to go to a shrine in Japan, this is called a tenbizu. The word is hand water, so you should avail yourself of that. There's a total openness in Japan about non-believers coming in and practicing whatever form of worship they want at the shrine. So this is kind of foreign to me as an American brought up in a different way. But yes, you just go in and you just start doing that. And by going through that process of washing your hands and rinsing your mouth, you're taking the first step to say, okay, I may not be, fully cognizant of what's happening here, but, it's not for me to decide. I'm just allowing that presence to come down into me.
Well, my experience of being at Shinto shrines in Kyoto, just kind of hanging out and watching people approach a part of the shrine that maybe was not very apparent to me why they were approaching that particular part and doing the two claps.
Yeah.
And it seemed like they were, it wasn't just being receptive, they were calling.
Yes. Okay. So there is the what's called the descent of the kami. So the kami aren't always with us. They aren't necessarily living at the shrine. But the shrine is actually the receptor or the place which the kami are most comfortable coming down to earth and being. So this process of clapping is exactly as you said. It's a call, it's a invocation. Come and be with me now. So this same kind of invocation is done in the music of Japan. So Hiroko and Sanai are performing this spring a piece of music called Kagura. And Kagura is this same thing. It's an invocation to the gods to descend and be with us at this moment. Oddly enough, this same kind of invocation occurs with, of all things, sumo wrestling. And with some of the other Japanese art. So these are called God entertainment. We are doing this to provide pleasure to the gods. Now, for me, this sounds all like a very funny thing to do, but when the gods are happy, we are happy as well. And this gets back to that core belief in Shinto that we are good and we are happy and we are blessed in that process. So, yes, comment.
In the Shinto shrine, there is a sanctuary area, and I was always, when I was a kid, I was always curious what's inside. Even though I have never had an opportunity to see what's inside, I was told there is a polished metal, looked like a mirror. And because the God resides within us, that's what the explanation that I was given. Particular type of Shintoism?
No, I think from what I know, most of the Shinto sects have this same concept of a mirror which is placed within the Holy of Holies. So there's a set of outer and inner sanctums to the shrine, the first being the torii, the gate, the big gate that we all know. So, it's important to walk through the gate, because when we walk through the gate, we leave the bad stuff behind us, and we enter the good area, the protected area. Then there's the shrine area itself, which is often enclosed in a wooden fenced area. This is also of a higher grade of holiness. The priests, the kanushi, and the shrine maidens will keep that area especially clean. They will sweep up all the dead leaves, they will rake up the rocks, and they will keep it in a dirt-free, very clean environment. And then we get into the shrine enclosure, which is usually some gorgeous architecture. And even within that, there are the sanctum and the inner sanctum. So what you've described is the mirror, which is, I believe the word is yoroshi. It becomes sort of like an antenna, a lightning rod, if you will, which attracts and brings the kami down to the earth. The kami doesn't live in the mirror. It's sort of a representation of their ability to come and be with us in that particular spot. So it's a hard concept for me to fully appreciate, and I'm not sure that my understanding is greater than yours, you probably have experienced it directly. No, okay.
Is that something like thou art that?
Something like?
Thou art that. The concept that whatever this great spirit is, it is you. You are part of that. Is that why it would be a mirror?
I don't know thou art that, so I'm not sure if I can answer that the same
way. The Hindu.
Okay. Yes, John.
What relationship do the Jisho figures have? You find along the
Jisho being
the figures you find along their little shrines.
Along
the roadways, is that part of Shinto?
Okay, yeah. That is part of Shinto. So, I believe those are for young children that have passed away. You see many, many of those along the roadside.
I thought they were Buddhist. Maybe there's that intertwining.
Okay. Anybody else know better than
I? It's a bodhisattva figure.
So more Buddhist.
Jizo. From a Buddhist perspective, Jizo is a bodhisattva. But from a Shinto perspective, Jizo is a comic. And so you'll find Jizo in both the Shinto context and the Buddhist context, and it does have a special relationship to children, and it also in a Buddhist context, Jizo will argue with the powers that be to help it get a good rebirth. So Jizo has a lot of functions, depending on the particular temple context. Which is hard for Westerners to grasp. The Jizo could morph its different meanings depending on the context. But we have Jizo statues here.
And smaller ones as well.
Yeah, we have smaller ones. Very, very popular.
I was told Jizo is also for the water child.
Yes.
That's how the Japanese people handle the loss of child, no matter what the reason is for loss. There is some areas that they couldn't afford to have a child, so they have to terminate the life in order for everybody else to survive because of the famines and things. So those are all included in kind of a water child offering, I think.
Thank you. That's a very important part. Thank you, Sue. I forgot to bring that up. Thank you very much.
Have you been able to serve to everybody? Yes. Anybody?
Mm-hmm.
We're in good shape.
How about you?
I would love a cup of tea.
Bochicha.
Now, for me, the mythology of Shinto is just fascinating. Yes?
I'm curious about the qualitative difference between the kind of mentality that you were saying is receptive to like Christianity that they would not be, it seems very strange to them.
Yes.
And I was wondering if there was any more discussion or observation there.
Anybody want to make a first-hand observation about your life and Christianity and Shinto? Anybody? It's been recounted to me that Christianity, having a leader, having a creed, having the idea of salvation, were such foreign concepts and distinct from Shinto that they were just not comprehensible to people who instead looked at life as being clean
and simple and good. So, is that what you...
Did that mentality spread among people who did not identify themselves as Shinto? What kind of receptivity did Christianity receive?
Okay, so the early Christian influence, starting with Francis Xavier and continuing for 80 or 90 years, did establish some foothold in Japan, and to my knowledge, it was also slightly modified. Christianity was slightly modified to meet their daily life needs, the way it has been in many other cultures around the world. I haven't studied that, so I can't answer your question in detail, other than to say that this slight modification would have taken on, you know, some of the key cultural aspects of Japan, you know, the deep rooting in agriculture, for instance, and the celebration of the festivals. So how they reconciled Jesus into this great pantheon, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, but you didn't think you did it.
Okay, okay.
And you satisfied me.
Okay.
Thank you.
I wanted to say that for me, the mythology is so wild, and it's a long story that goes on and on, as these kinds of stories do. I wanted to just share with you a piece of it, which I think illustrates one of the key concepts that I wanted to share with you. But before I did that, I needed to just share with you from this same tome a list of what are called the heavenly sins. The heavenly sins are breaking down the ridges, covering up the ditches, releasing the irrigation sluices, double planting, setting up stakes, skinning alive, skinning backward, defecation. These are not the sins that I grew up with. However, it illustrates that at this time, when this was set down, agriculture played an enormous role in the development of the country. Agriculture was everything. So with that as the background, I wanted to read a short passage from the Kojiki about two of the gods. These were brother and sister. Susanoo is the god of the sea, and Amaterasu is the sun god. And it picks up from the creation of several other gods at that point. And Susanoo blusters out and says, "It was because my intentions were pure and clear that in the children I begot, I obtained graceful maidens. By this it is obvious that I have won." Thus saying, he raged with victory, breaking down the ridges of Amaterasu's rice paddies and filling up the ditches. He also defecated and strewed his feces about in the hall where the first fruits were tasted. Even though he did this, Amaterasu did not reprove him, but said, "What appears to be feces must be what my brother has vomited and strewn about while drunk. Also, as to his breaking down the ridges and the rice paddies and filling up the ditches, my brother must have done so because he felt land was being wasted." Even though she spoke thus in remedy, his misdeeds did not cease, but became even more flagrant. When Amaterasu was inside the sacred weaving hall, seeing to the weaving of the divine garments, he opened up a hole in the roof of the weaving hall and dropped into it the heavenly dappled horse which he had skinned backward. The heavenly weaving maiden, shocked at the sight, struck her genitals against the shuttle and died. Now Amaterasu, seeing this, became afraid, and opening the door of the heavenly rock cave,
went in and shut herself inside, then the plain of high heaven was completely dark, and the central land of the reed plains was entirely dark. Because of this, constant night reigned, and the cries of the myriad deities filled the air like flies in the summer, and all manners of calamities arose. And then it goes on. Well, so here we have this awful set of deeds being promulgated by one of the key deities in the earthly realm. And I think for me, this story speaks directly to the cleanliness versus uncleanliness aspect of Shinto. Cleanliness is one of the key concepts. We must be clean in our bodies and in our hearts and minds. And we must get rid of all uncleanness. So this, to me, is the great story. It goes on and on to some more wonderful aspects which we can't get into. I'm sure that you know this tonight. But I wanted to bring that out because I wanted to speak directly about what some of the key values are of Shinto. So if you're following along, I'm gonna skip over this unless we have time to come back to it. So clean versus unclean, rather than good versus evil. In our culture, we define good versus evil as the predominant theme. But in Japan, in Shinto, it's clean versus unclean. So the daily struggle is to get rid of death and decay, impure thoughts and wrong actions. And so we perform rituals in Shinto to cleanse ourselves and to thereby bring ourselves back into a state of goodness or cleanliness or brightness or so forth. The other core value that I find really interesting is that Shinto has an emphasis on this life rather than life after death. And in my upbringing, I was always kind of obsessed about life after death. What happens, Mom? What happens, Dad, when I die? And I think this is both cultural and religious in terms of my background. But there, in Shinto, there's really no preoccupation with the final disposition. Am I going to go to heaven or am I going to go to hell? It's really not a question that we dwell on in Shinto. So that's very different. The principal pursuit of the religious faithful is therefore cleansing rather than salvation. Those of us that have a Christian background have sought salvation from this original sin that was placed upon us. But since there is no such concept in Shinto, we instead are searching for this cleansing from impurities, which kind of, we walk through it every day. It kind of builds up on it. It kind of covers us with the mundane parts of our life. And so we need to repeatedly get rid of this, either through emotions or rituals or bathing, obviously our body itself, but more importantly, our mind and our actions and our thoughts has to be cleansed on a regular basis. That brings us back to this state of goodness and brightness. And the other key feature that I find really interesting, core value I'm calling it here, is that Shinto is basically an optimistic faith. not a pessimistic faith. It's grounded in the belief in the inherent goodness of earth and humanity. This is really refreshing to me, really refreshing, because my own personal beliefs are very strongly tied to ecology and earth. And you know, this concept of Gaia is really appealing. Gaia being earth is a whole living organism and has self-balancing processes. This is directly in line with the Shinto belief system. And when someone told me one time that Shinto is basically an ecological religion, I couldn't believe it. But I thought about it and I thought, yes, it really is. It's okay, people have been calling it sort of an earth-based animistic religion, and that wasn't doing it for me. But when they called it an ecological religion, I kind of got that. And so it has implications for today's world and the problems that we're facing with, say, for example, nuclear energy, climate change, deforestation, some of the evils that we've inflicted upon ourselves with our actions on this earth. I think Shinto has some direct helping ways to help us correct our mistakes in those areas. Okay. I had some other readings, but I will just leave it at that for now. How are we doing? We must have generated a bunch of questions by now. Yeah.
Is Shinto organized the way some other religions are, with a central authority and a structure?
No. There was a brief period when it was, but Shinto has always been community-based, almost neighborhood-based. And because of that, the shrines and the enshrined kami were cared for originally by local volunteers, by the community, by people who just cared for that presence being in their life. And over time, what was originally just an open space, perhaps a rock, or a tree, or some other designated place where the kami could descend, became a little bit more designated, and we started to build physical structures around them. And so then we had some permanent place within the community. And those were also cared for through local volunteers, through donations, and so forth. Then there's the exception to the rule, which is during the Meiji Restoration, 1868, the closed architecture of Japan was finally broken down, the West was brought in, trade was started, and the Japanese government at that time decided to institutionalize all of the shrines. And so there are today something like 88,000 shrines. They were all supported by the state, so government funding went into it, and some organizations were established to dole out the money and to make sure that, you know, buildings were kept up and so forth and so on. That was all dismantled after World War II. So with the United States winning the war, we forced upon them the dissolution of that state structure which was supporting the shrines. And so today, we're back to where we were for many centuries, and nearly all of the shrines are supported by volunteers, with the exception of there's some imperial lineage, some shrines associated with the emperor, which are still funded and supported by the state. Yes, questions?
You spoke of temple priests and temple maidens.
Yes.
What was their function and how were they selected?
I'm not sure how they're selected. I know that there is a college that Shinto, someone who's interested in a profession in Shinto can go to and become a kanushi, a priest, in which he would learn the rites, the rituals, the ways to do various ceremonies. And then the shrine maidens are, I need some help. What are the shrine maidens there for besides helping out with the regular duties of I can't answer the part because it's been somewhat of an open question for me as well. Yeah.
Are the priests necessary, or can you approach the kami on your own?
They're not necessary.
They're not necessary. It's not like you have to have a priest to pray for you.
That's
like
correct.
The Catholics,
you don't.
Perhaps.
And I have read, and I believe that the best way to approach the shrine is individually with an open heart. And in those cases, you don't need to have any officiating person. So there's really no concept of a Sabbath. There's no homilies or sermons. There's no Wednesday night Bible studies. What they have are community events, and the community events would be something like Ikebana, flower arranging, or something similar in nature, where ordinary people would come into the area of the shrine and would just be in the presence of others who have that same open heart, working towards getting rid of all the mundane aspects of your life. So it's that way that is used to what I've been calling this osmosis process, where you kind of learn by being in that space. The other part, though, which is a really wonderful part, and I think most of us have experienced this, are the festivals. They're called Matsuri. And Matsuri are these grand celebrations where the god who was enshrined, that little mirror part, is carefully taken out and moved into a portable palanquin called a mikoshi. And then the faithful, the community, pick it up and they carry it out into the streets, and with great jubilation and you know, hefty drumming and so forth, they just have a rollicking good time carrying the god through the neighborhoods, thereby bestowing his blessings, the kami's blessings, on the whole community, and in particular on those who participate in that ritual of carrying it around.
When you were telling this, the myth of the two gods,
yes,
it had interesting similarities as well as obvious differences with the classical myth of Persephone being carried off by Hades, and then Demeter saying, "It's going to be dark and cold from here on out because you guys abused your powers." Do you think there are similarities, or do you think it's just these are points of crossing in different directions?
I think there are similarities. I am not fluent in that story that you've just quoted, but I see this same kind of sort of the division between light and dark in many of our great religions of the world.
Where the light was female in this, and when she left, all the gods got very cold, and they didn't get the sacrifices they were anticipating, and they finally backed down.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In the classical myth.
I see.
Except that Persephone had eaten a few pomegranate seeds while she was in Hades, so for those months she had to go back, and then had winter and darkness. But basically it meant that the female powers, when push came to shove, were stronger and had to be treated with a respect they hadn't been.
Uh-huh.
In the classical story.
Yeah. In this, the extended version of this, which I didn't read, there's also some tug and pull between the male and the female about who is greater and who is the dominant force and so forth. And it's sort of left, in my mind, unresolved, both of them boasting that they're the better sex. So I don't know how to answer the question in terms of comparison, other than to say this is one of the great stories of humanity, is the struggle between light and darkness.
Can you tell us something about the symbolism of what's on the table?
Okay. This is called an omomori. So they're, for lack of a better word, they're lucky charms. You can buy them at any shrine. And some of them, I brought a list of what they're used for. But they're basically to carry with you the blessings of the god that came from that particular temple. There's one of these. I don't know which one this is, but there's one for traffic safety. Very practical thing. Now, we have, you know, who is it, Christopher?
Saint Christopher,
who fills the same role. Yeah. This is sort of an ever-popular one, and almost every car has one of these for that purpose. You can also get these for just general good luck and better fortune. You can also get one specifically for education and passing your examination. This is important in a, you know, a highly educated society. Prosperity in business, finding a mate and a good marriage, protection for pregnant women, and just general purpose safety. The way these work is inside that little pouch is a sacred object which has been blessed by the Kanushi. You're never really supposed to open those up. Inside that sacred object is, through a process which is very similar to sort of a propagation, how do you call this? When you have two, when you have one thing and you end up with two of them.
Clone.
A clone. It's a cloning process. So, I don't remember the Japanese word for it, but there is a cloning process which is used by shrines. I mentioned that there were 88,000 shrines in Japan. There aren't 88,000 distinct gods, but a shrine can take the enshrined kami and clone it through a special ritual and thereby bring it to another shrine that worships the same deity. The same kind of process on a slightly different scale works with these. And so we're actually carrying with us the kami. And so it's important, two things about it. One is it's important not to keep it for longer than a year. You have to return them. And the other is, you don't just throw them away. They are sacred. So you need to bring them back to the shrine where you bought them, and they will properly, ritually, rejoin them with the main kami and dispose of them properly. So that's what this is. This other thing here is called a sakaki. It's a traditional Japanese tree, which is considered to be one of the sacred trees of Japan. And it's here for my sake, just to bless this particular area. And these little, I'm not sure everybody can see these little zigzag white papers, are shide, and they are used also to attract the unclean. And the unclean goes into them. And we use them once only, and then we throw them away. So all the impurities go into those. And we see those at just about every place that has some connection with the company.
Do you ritually dispose of them, or just toss them in the trash?
What's the right way to get rid of these things? Anybody know?
Burn them?
I don't know the answer to that one, and I'm probably not doing it the right way.
My grandmother was burned.
Okay.
And then mixed with water and create that kind of a moistened ash, and then she would put around the house. But I don't know if that's a proper way or...
I have heard that story before. Thank you. Thank you. Question?
So you kind of mentioned at the end of your talk a little bit about kind of what Shinto may have to offer these times of kind of what we're going through globally. And so I've lived and worked in Fukushima for 3 years inside of the exclusion zone where Daiichi is located. And so my friends from that time are all displaced out of the village and can't go home. And so I have a great deal of survivor's guilt from not. And so my question to you is, do you have any words in terms of how can I use Shinto as a bridge to kind of to relate to my family and friends who have gone through this?
Yes. Well, I was deeply touched by the events that transpired in March of 2011. Although I was several hundred kilometers away, I think the whole world was aware of what was happening, and our hearts were broken, all of us. First, just the earthquake was just so devastating. It took 6 weeks to repair some of the main bullet trains going north. Second was just the tremendous devastation caused by the tsunami, horrific, and the loss of life was so bad that it just, to me, really broke my heart. And sadly, the final tragedy was the Fukushima meltdowns, of which there were 3 of the power plants out of the 6 melted to the core, and 4 of the spent fuel rods also had severe damage and were considered to be a meltdown. This is an international tragedy. It's a crime against humanity, as far as I'm concerned. So, trying to make sense of that, I began writing, and that's the genesis of this book that I wrote over here, and it kind of goes through 2 things. One is a thread of just, here's Joe just having a good time in the world and enjoying himself and learning about Shinto and learning about Kagura music. It's a wonderful time, and you know, life is good. And the other part is this thread of the disasters as they opened these wounds in all of our hearts. And I brought them together in the last chapter with a story about ghosts. And it's not something that most people have gotten so far, but I will share with you, since you're a receptive audience, that actually the last chapter of my book is really a prayer. It's a prayer that the people of Japan will see what they are doing with nuclear power, and that they will make the right choices, and they will return to their Shinto origins, their Shinto faith, and use that as a way to say, no, nuclear power is not clean energy. Essentially, it's dirty energy wrapped in all these clean words that we have pronounced about it. So that's one aspect. To more directly answer you, though, part of what I believe is the greatness of Shinto is this aspect of celebrating your ancestors. So when we die, it's not a matter of
where do I go? It's more a matter of how do the people who are left remain in contact with me? It's, to me, it's an upside down way of thinking about life and death. And there's this beautiful ritual which occurs during the seventh month of the year called Obon, where we celebrate with song and dance, and we ask the gods and our ancestors to come back and be with us. And I think for all those who were displaced at Fukushima, who cannot be in their homeland, who can't farm their fields, who can't be in the place where they grew up, that this ceremony of Obon, of being with your ancestors and all the kami, provides to me some comfort and connection to this greater goodness that I think is the greatness of Shinto. If you can, come to the Obon Festival over here at the temple this July. It's usually the second week of July. It's a wonderful event. We have run out of time, and I sense that there may be a few more questions. Is there any one or two last burning questions that have to be answered? No, we're good. Okay, then I will say thank you for your attention, and I will return it back for some final announcements.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much on behalf of Many Rivers, and thank you all for coming tonight. And thank you very much for our generous brewers and distributors of tea, very much appreciated and enjoyed by myself and many others. So thank you so much for that friendly component for the evening. So we have a donation basket in this case over here on the counter, as well as the bowl. We have Mr. Hanten's book, There's a God for That, here, as well as other books on Shinto from our Shinto section. We are one of those rare stores that has a Shinto section outside of Japan. Maybe the only store outside of Japan, I don't know. And I also want to thank you all for coming tonight, and look forward to seeing you again throughout 2013 here at Many Rivers. Thank you so much.
How about the Donna Bowl?
And
Donna Bowl is right over there.
20% off all G shows.
Okay, all right. Stuart has pronounced it. 20% off this lovely Jiso and the one over there, and probably there's one or two others around the store. As well. So thank you so much. Jim's gonna.